This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. Welcome to it. I'm Bill Radke. On today's show, you will meet the author of The Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the quest to colonize the cosmos. We're going to talk about the perspective you get when you see Earth from far above without any of its international boundaries. But for now, we still live in countries. And our first story is all about those international boundaries. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today on President Trump's travel ban. And based on what we heard this morning, President Trump appears likely to win. Remember, this is Trump's indefinite ban on people traveling here from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, also North Korea and some government officials from Venezuela. The court will decide whether the president has the right to keep out certain immigrants if he says it's a matter of national security. Arguing today for the Trump administration, here is U.S. Solicitor General Noel Francisco.
The proclamation reflects a foreign policy and national security judgment that falls well within the president's power under 1182F and has been successful.
Well within the president's power. Arguing against the travel ban was former Obama administration acting Solicitor General Neil Katyal. He disagreed.
The executive order is unlawful for three reasons. It conflicts with Congress's policy choices. It defies the bar on nationality discrimination, something you never heard my friend talk about. And it violates the First Amendment.
Remember, Washington State was one of the states suing President Trump over this executive order, the original one. In fact, a Seattle federal judge temporarily halted Trump's first travel ban last year. So let's understand what happened today with Associate Professor of Law Lisa Marshall Mannheim at the University of Washington. Welcome, Professor.
Hi, thanks so much.
We heard a little bit of it, but what are the basic arguments the court was wrestling with this morning?
So when a president acts, he has to overcome two basic legal hurdles. The first is that every action he takes has to have some sort of basis in the law, and that can come either from a law passed by Congress, which was that reference that the lawyer made to 1182F. So that's a law passed by Congress. Or alternatively, it can come from the Constitution. But he has to have some basis. And so one of the arguments in this case that the challenges are raising is that President Trump has no basis in law for issuing this sort of order.
Basis in law. Okay. And there are some other questions the Supreme Court is sorting through. What are some of those others?
So the next question is, even if the president has some sort of basis in law for what he's done, he can't exercise that authority in a way that violates some sort of other legal restriction, for example, the First Amendment. And so the lawyers in this case are not only arguing that President Trump lacked a basis in law for issuing this ban to begin with, they're also arguing that even if he had that basis, he can't do it in a way that, in this case, arguably discriminates against people of a certain religion, which in this case would be people who are Muslim.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the issue of what Hawaii chose to do.
In terms of suing the president?
That injunction, the nationwide injunction on implementing that.
Absolutely. So there are further controversies both at the start of the case, in a sense, and at the end of the case. So at the start of the case, there's a question of whether the courts can hear this sort of challenge to begin with. And the arguments there are pretty technical, but they boil down to, on the one hand, the court's interest in deferring to the president quite a bit in matters of national security and often in matters of immigration. And then on the other hand, there's a question of whether the courts can hear claims that, in a sense, are brought by people who aren't American citizens, who don't live in the country, and who don't have a clear tie to the United States. So there's a question whether the courts can hear this case at all. And then on the back end, there's the question, even if the courts can hear the case, even if the challengers are correct that the president somehow has overstepped his legal authority, what sort of relief or remedy should these challengers get? And the government is arguing that it should be very narrow, maybe just covering a few people, whereas the challengers want to argue that it should essentially require the federal government to stop enforcing the ban altogether.
The justices also need to consider Trump's campaign pledges and tweets about keeping out Muslims versus his decisions as president. Will you explain that?
Absolutely. So this is one of the crucial debates among the parties, and something that the Supreme Court has to figure out, which is, is the Supreme Court going to look at the face of this executive order, which does not, again, on its face discriminate against people of a certain religion? Or is the court willing and required to look beyond the face of the order to what might be motivating it without the order itself acknowledging it? And so the challengers are trying to argue that the court should do the latter and then look to President Trump's campaign statements, a number of statements he's made that explicitly connect these travel bans to those campaign statements. Or on the other hand, should the court then do what the government wants it to do, which is, again, just to look to the face of the order and conclude that because on its face it's not discriminatory, there's no reason to be concerned about something like the First Amendment.
Right. The president's lawyers were saying, don't look at campaign statements, that the taking the oath of office, that's a, quote, fundamental transformation.
Yes, and so that there's some dispute over that. So different, the Supreme Court has not resolved this. It's very much a legal question whether that, it, in a sense, the taking the oath of office changes the nature of the individual so much that you don't continue to connect those prior statements to things that he then does in office. That being said, the challengers to this travel ban are actually arguing that after taking office, President Trump, as president, made comments that, in a sense, referred back to those campaign statements. So the challengers would argue that even if the campaign statements themselves can't be used, the President Trump's comments since taking office can be used, and the result is essentially the same.
Have we ever had a Supreme Court case like this where we're parsing a president's stated opinions and then trying to figure out, well, should we hold those against the president when and try to figure out the president's motivations and whether those could be discriminatory?
You know, not to my knowledge. To my knowledge, there's not a case that's really on point with this one. And one of the reasons is because the court really is reluctant in a lot of circumstances to look beyond the face of what a governmental actor or the government has done, because it poses very complicated questions of proof and deference and the like. And frankly, we also haven't seen a case like this because some of the actions that President Trump has taken are themselves without precedent. And I don't know that we have an example just on the facts like the one we have here, where a president has campaigned on something that was so legally problematic and then seemingly has tried to implement it in a way that arguably bypasses some of those legal prohibitions.
Right. So I said at the beginning, Professor, that President Trump, based on what happened this morning, seems in good shape to win this case. Do you agree with that assessment, and why? How did justices react this morning to the arguments?
Well, you know, whenever you're talking about the Supreme Court, you kind of have to count to five, because you need five justices to agree with your claim in order to win. And it's just hard for the challengers, I think, in this case, to count to five. There are four justices, the more conservative-leaning justices, who seem pretty, through either their argument in this, their discussion this morning, or from prior rulings they've issued, they seem pretty hostile to the challenger's argument. So the question is which, if any, of the other five justices might be willing to support the challenger side, and it's just not really clear that there's anybody. There were some of the justices were agreeing with the challengers that Congress's actions in this area seem to possibly foreclose the president's ability to do this. But then once you get up to the potential fifth vote, the person that would be the most likely to do that would be Justice Kennedy. And Justice Kennedy's questions and argument all suggested, in a sense, that he thinks that this manifestation of the travel ban is not as problematic as the prior manifestations of the travel ban, because this one has gone through more of a process. So if that's what Justice Kennedy thinks, that's bad news for the challengers.
Final question then, Professor. After the first version of this policy, there was chaos. There were protests in American airports, including SeaTac Airport. Travelers were being stopped from boarding international flights, getting detained for hours. Lower courts blocked that travel ban. In a nutshell, why do you think the U.S. Supreme Court justices apparently see this differently? Is that a matter of the justices' politics or a different perspective?
You know, I think there's two main differences that to help to explain why this travel ban is not exactly the same as that first travel ban. The first main difference is that first one was announced without any warning, and so the implementation was very chaotic. And in fact, one of the reasons why the courts enjoined that first travel ban was because the process was so chaotic, and people who were affected by it weren't given a clear means by which to seek a hearing or to push back on its implementation. The second reason why at least the government wants to argue that this version of the travel ban is different than that first one is because of those procedures that I alluded to. So the first one seemed to be just maybe a small number of people deciding to write up this order and then to issue it very quickly, whereas this most recent travel ban, the one that's currently before the Supreme Court, it did go through you know, at least as a formality, it went through a lot of procedures. So that it feels less problematic for some as a result of that process.
Lisa Marshall Manheim is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Washington. A decision is expected from the U.S. Supreme Court by late June, and Professor Manheim there is agreeing with the consensus that for the challengers in this case, it's going to be hard to count to five and get five justices. So looks like a probable victory for the president. We'll see. Professor Manheim, Lisa Marshall Manheim, thanks a lot for this.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle, and we're going to be right back. This is The Record on KUOW. We're live tweeting the program at KUOW. The hashtag MeToo movement has changed the way things are done in newsrooms, boardrooms, and now maybe on your daily commute. King County Metro Transit has seen a rise in sexual misconduct complaints in 2016 and 2017. They want to expand riders' awareness about how to report incidents and hopefully stop them from happening in the first place. Seattle Times staff reporter Jessica Lee reported on the county's campaign. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did the county's numbers show?
So, specifically, since October, when the social media phenomenon launched globally, more people came forward to Metro Transit saying that they've been inappropriately touched or they've experienced lewd comments, indecent exposure, some form of sexual misconduct on the transit agency's buses. It's really been a surge in the last few months, and they attribute it to people feeling more comfortable to having these types of conversations.
Yes, sexual harassment, lewd comments, indecent exposure. And are you saying that King County Metro doesn't think there's an increase in harassment, et cetera, or it's just a matter of more reporting because of awareness in the Me Too movement?
Sure. It's a little hard to answer that question just because Metro Transit has seen such a huge spike in ridership over the last few years, even within the last few months with our booming population here in the region. So with more people, obviously there's more odds of inappropriate and violent behavior. So there could definitely be potentially a growing number of reports, but they're unable to really verify that.
Your story says that other transit networks are also reevaluating how they handle claims. What are other models doing here?
So Metro Transit looked out to places from Vancouver, BC, to Boston, to New York, to even London, and they're also trying to create this open conversation through public awareness and also training with their operators, mechanics, deputies, to make sure that everyone is on the same playing field to put this as a number one priority for passengers.
And what is King County Metro doing to make that reporting happen?
So it's going to first start off as open communication and a messaging campaign. They're going to have deputies talking to passengers. So Metro Transit has its own police, and there are about 50 deputies that are also trained through the Sheriff's Department, and they're putting this in the front of their mind as they're out there riding buses. And also through any sort of educational events that they can hold.
Posters on buses, too, we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
What does that poster look like?
So it's a woman with her hand out in the stop motion and with the words, "Report it, stop it." And there's a few that have that same image.
If you're a Metro passenger and you're a victim of harassment, comments, indecent exposure, what are you supposed to do?
So everyone should feel comfortable approaching their driver, because all drivers have received this training on how to respond by activating an emergency alarm system or using the radios that connects to a dispatch center, and that dispatch center will right away alert authorities. So that's something that Metro Transit is really promoting, the fact that all drivers are on this equal playing field with knowing how to handle any type of sexual misconduct. If a person doesn't feel comfortable approaching a driver, or doesn't have access, or is feeling threatened and really unable to, they can call 911, of course, or call the sheriff's office non-emergency line to make a report. If they do the latter, if they call, they're going to need to know their bus number, and then also the route that they're going and the direction that they're traveling.
What kind of training do Metro bus drivers have in handling sexual misconduct?
So basically what I just mentioned, activating the tools that they have available to them to get law enforcement involved, because really it's law enforcement who have the right training to be able to deal, especially if it's a severe situation. But a lot of drivers know how to mediate and have certain crisis management skills that come apart with being a part of the Metro Transit team.
We're talking about King County Metro's new campaign against sexual harassment called Report It to Stop It. Report It to Stop It is the message. Jessica Lee is a staff reporter for the Seattle Times, and she wrote a story about an increase in reports of lewd comments, sexual harassment, and indecent exposure on Metro buses. And she wrote about Metro's reforms. We're tweeting out that report right now to you at KUOW. Seattle Times, Jessica Lee, thanks a lot for this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, let's bring in a listener. We're going to call Kay. This is someone who wrote to us at KUOW with her story. Kay, welcome to KUOW. Thanks for writing.
Thank you so much.
Will you please tell us what happened to you on a Metro bus?
Yeah. So a couple months ago, I got on a bus and an individual got on after me and sat down next to me. And throughout the ride to downtown, some of the passengers, I noticed that this individual was exhibiting some erratic behavior, not something you would normally see on a bunch of commuters. During the ride, this individual reached down with his hand and stroked my leg, going from my knee up towards my crotch. And I didn't want to find out where his hand was going. And I got up as quickly as I could and went to the front of the bus.
You went to the front of the bus, and then what did you do?
I informed the bus driver, an individual, stroked my leg, and the bus driver immediately said, "That's assault. I'm calling this in." And then asked me to stay at the front of the bus with him. And then he called it in, so there would be a Metro sheriff at the first stop downtown when we got there, and then just continue to ask me questions. Is the individual still back there? Can you describe him to me? Are you okay? And I was like, well, not what I expected to happen on the bus this morning. But overall, the bus driver is actually very sort of calm and helpful in this situation.
How was this person, this guy, how was he acting toward you? Was he making eye contact? What was going on?
No, I was doing my best to avoid any sort of eye contact, verbal contact, physical contact with this individual, mostly because I, you know, didn't want to start a situation, get involved in a situation, and was just sitting there trying to mind my own business to go to where I was going.
How were passengers reacting, if at all?
So one of the women who was sitting across from me was noticing some of the behavior leading up to the incident. I don't think she saw the actual incident, but as we would make eye contact occasionally. And then when she got off the bus, when we were stopped downtown waiting for the Metro Transit officer, she got off and told the driver, "You need to kick this guy off the bus." So apparently he had continued sort of acting erratically, strangely after I had gone, and overall was just not really acting like you normally should riding the bus.
Okay, so you're off the bus at this point, and what happened next?
So eventually the King County Metro Sheriff Deputy arrived. I told him the story. The bus driver had got my contact information. The sheriff officer got my contact information, and they got on the bus to talk to the individual, and I left because I never done this before. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. So I went about my day. And it wasn't until the next day that I got in contact with they contacted me again about the situation.
And what did they, when they contacted you, what did they say?
So they called and asked and, you know, confirmed that I was the person, and they asked if I wanted to pursue a case. And they're like, oh. And the conversation went on, and there's like, they said, wait, no one contacted you yesterday? And I said, no, no one did. And it turns out the individual was a level 3 sex offender, and they had arrested him, or they had put out a warrant for his arrest. I don't think he had been arrested yet. And so immediately at that point, like, I lived down the street from a school. The bus stop where we got on is a children's bus stop. And I freaked out even more. And so I decided to testify in court against this individual, and they were able to arrest him.
You testified in court, and what happened?
So when we got to court, the judge made a ruling that we weren't allowed to discuss the individual's prior sexual offender status. And so we went through trial. We watched all of the bus video from beginning to end in real time. At the end, the jury found him not guilty, which was kind of infuriating to me. But the silver lining is that there was actually a warrant out for this individual's arrest on the East Coast, and they were able to extradite him out of the state. So in the grand scheme of things, it ended well, and that this individual is no longer in the area on the streets. But at the same time, it was not the most pleasant process for me, essentially.
How do you think, we've been talking here about how Metro is responding to an increase in reports of sexual misconduct. In your case, Kay, how did Metro do, in your opinion?
In my opinion, Metro did well in terms of having the responsive bus driver and knowing the procedures for calling. It would have been probably better for the court case if they had stopped people getting off the bus to ask them if they would stick around to also talk to the deputy. I was the only person who testified. But, you know, that was one case on one day, and I'm sure there are other cases where maybe you can't get to the front of the bus, or you know, someone is actively, you know, preventing you from doing something. So I consider myself very lucky in the situation to have the scenario that I had.
How long have you been riding the bus, Kay?
Many years. Let's see here. I got here December of 2012, since January of 2013.
Okay, 4 or 5 years. And mm-hmm. How often have you experienced any kind of what Metro is calling sexual misconduct on a Metro bus?
So that was the only overt time that there was physical contact.
But Metro is including lewd comments and exposure.
Yeah.
And yeah, how often does this happen to you?
To me personally, not very frequently. It's mostly maybe just a comment here and there, but on the bus that I ride, usually about once a week, someone will say something to another passenger, or, you know, someone will be acting in a behavior that is probably not appropriate for that bus scenario that's making other people uncomfortable.
Could you give me an example? What are we talking about?
There have been several domestic altercations where there's been screaming and yelling. And in those cases, the bus driver has pulled over and either told the people to get off or, you know, try to intervene. But, you know, mostly it's, you know, verbal. I haven't really seen physical on my bus route.
Okay, that's people having a private fight, not examples of the sexual misconduct we're talking about.
I guess, yeah. But I also try to keep my head down and, you know, not get into trouble on the bus ride. So it's entirely possible things are happening that I'm not seeing.
Right. Kay, thanks. We talked in general about this rise in the number of reported sexual misconduct incidents, and I really appreciate your writing in and giving us the specifics on something that happened to you. And it sounds like you give Metro a mostly passing grade in the grand scheme of things, as you said.
Yep.
Yeah. Kay, thank you for writing in and talking with us on KUOW.
Thank you for letting me tell my story.
And thank you for listening. This is The Record, and we're going to be right back and talk about the Space Barons. Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Paul Allen's on the list. Their quest to colonize the cosmos in a moment. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. When Jeff Bezos isn't shaping Seattle, he's got his eye on space. Bezos has a company that makes reusable rockets. He makes them, launches them, lands them. And he's not alone. There's another billionaire entrepreneur who's neck and neck with Bezos in the rocket business. And as my next guest says, rivalry makes the best rocket fuel. My guest is author Christian Davenport, whose new book is called The Space Barons: Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. Welcome, Christian.
Thanks for having me.
Colonize the cosmos. What does that mean? What's their goal?
Well, in Elon's case, what he wants to do is create essentially a backup for the human race. I mean, let's remember, these are, you know, billionaires with big visions and long track records. But Elon's goal is to actually go to Mars and find another planet for humanity to live on. What Jeff Bezos wants to do is essentially have humanity go off Earth into space, not necessarily to any one particular point, but just be going out into space. Now, obviously, those are huge aspirational goals that are maybe generations away. But in the more near term, what they want to do is to create affordable, reliable access to space. Just make it easier. Right now, getting to space is so hard. It's so complicated. It's so expensive. And what these guys want to do is bring the cost down dramatically, have more launches, more people going to space.
I understand Elon Musk's goal. You said a backup. We need a second home. We need an HQ2. But in the case of Bezos, he wants to travel to space more, but to what end?
So the idea, as he would say, is that plan B should be to make sure plan A works. In other words, you go out to space to save the Earth, right? Earth is limited. There are so many resources here that can get used up. And yet our population is expanding. Our demand for resources is expanding. So what Jeff wants to do is to go into space and mine the abundant resources of space and asteroids, all of that solar energy that's unfiltered, and bring it back to help make humanity's existence on Earth, which, you know, we sort of evolved here. It's a great place to make life here better. And his ultimate goal, as he says, is millions of people living and working in space.
He wants to mine what from asteroids and other
rocks?
There
are precious metals. There are all sorts of resources that you could use for energy and then bring those back down to Earth. The other thing is that when you're in space, you know, here we use solar energy, but there's nighttime. You can't get it then. There's the atmosphere, which dilutes it. But in space, it's abundant. And you could harness it there and bring it back to Earth. And then that way, you know, humanity can sort of grow. He said this for a long time. He says, you know, he wants Earth to be zoned residential.
Yes.
Right? And he's even talked about that. He talked about that as a kid in high school, saying Earth should be, you know, preserved as a national park and that all heavy industry goes out into space. Which, again, this is the long-term goal.
And then, space is the industrial neighborhood.
That's right, where you do all of your mining and all of your heavy lifting. But to get there, for that to happen, you've got to make it accessible. And right now, it's just too hard to go. So that's what they have in common.
I can think of a few others uses, quote unquote, for space. There's space tourism. There's spying on Earthlings. There's waging war. Does any of that figure into? Obviously, space tourism is big in this.
Well, yeah, and actually, all of those figure in. So first, what Jeff wants to do, and this is coming up soon. I mean, we could have first flights, test flights. From Blue Origin, their site out in West Texas, on their suborbital vehicle, which is named New Shepard, which goes straight up and comes straight back down. But they're talking about putting paying customers on those flights within a couple of years, where you've got people now. They haven't announced the price for that. This is something also that Richard Branson wants to do with his company, Virgin Galactic. But the idea is, you go up in the rocket, you have a few minutes where you're 100 kilometers in space, you unbuckle your seatbelt, you float around the cabin. Blue Origin talks a lot about the giant windows that they have in their spacecraft so that you could see the curvature of the Earth, the thin line of the atmosphere, and the blackness of space. You float around for 4 or 5 minutes, then get back in your seat, buckle up, and come down. They're also bidding on Blue Origin plans to bid on national security contracts, which is something that SpaceX has already done. There's big money there from the Pentagon that launches satellites for the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies. So, you know, there's a lot going on.
This is author Christian Davenport. The book is The Space Barons: Elon Musk, you call him. Yeah. Like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. Why isn't NASA doing this near-to-Earth work anymore.
So a lot of people don't realize this, but NASA and the U.S. government does not have the ability to fly humans from U.S. soil. And we haven't had that capability since 2011 when the space shuttle was retired. So the idea was NASA said, you know what, we're going to get out of what's known as low Earth orbit. That's where the International Space Station is, about 250 miles up in terms of providing the transportation. We're going to turn that over to the private sector. So SpaceX and a company called Orbital ATK already have contracts with NASA to fly cargo and supplies and experiments to the International Space Station. Coming up next is flying crews. So there's a public-private partnership that's going on there where NASA has given SpaceX, frankly, a lot of money. I mean, we're talking on the order of billions of dollars in contracts to help them develop their rockets and build this industry, this growing commercial space industry, where NASA then becomes a customer and it hires these companies for rides to the International Space Station.
Is NASA the only customer, or are these billionaires also working with other governments?
So they right now, NASA is a big customer, but for example, for SpaceX, they also have the Pentagon, which we talked about. They fly commercial satellites for commercial companies that they do. And in fact, SpaceX has got quite a backlog now that Blue Origin is building its next generation rocket. That one's called New Glenn after John Glenn, which would be able to go to orbit and then compete with SpaceX for these launch contracts, not just with NASA, with the Pentagon, and with the commercial sector.
But what about other countries? Are these entrepreneurs working equally or planning to work with other companies, just, or is this a USA effort?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because what the Trump administration wants to do in its plan to go to the moon is not just leverage the capabilities of these companies, as they're doing now in low Earth orbit, but to work with international partners as well. Thing is, getting into deep space, getting to the moon or even to Mars is just so difficult that they would have to all partner together. But as of right now, SpaceX does have contracts to fly payloads for foreign countries as well and foreign companies. So, yeah.
Yeah. Bezos is American. Elon Musk is South African, Canadian American.
That's right.
Yeah. Who regulates what they do?
Well, so the FAA grants them launch licenses, and they have to ensure that, you know, there is the safety for people and property on the ground. In terms of human spaceflight and space tourism, it's really quite interesting. There was the first commercial flight to space. I mean, the first time was not a government. It was a privately backed venture. It was Paul Allen.
Spaceship One.
Spaceship One in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
The Ansari X Prize went to pass the threshold of space three times. And that set off the regulator saying, wait, this might be a moment where all of a sudden people are going to space routinely and we need to regulate this. And the industry, you know, pushed back really hard and said, no, wait, we're just getting started here. You know, we want a lot of room to experiment and to innovate. And if there are all these regulations on us, we're not going to be able, the industry is going to die in the crib. So now it's essentially an informed consent standard, like skydiving or bungee jumping. And they tell you, you know, you this is really dangerous. And you say, okay, I'm going to do it anyway. Uh-huh. That's, you know, that's what the standard is.
We've now mentioned Paul Allen, the Microsoft co-founder, and you mentioned Richard Branson. Your two main characters, though, are Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. And you see them as a tortoise and the hare contrast. What are their two different approaches to the space business?
Well, you know, SpaceX and Elon have really, you know, are winning this race right out of the gate.
They're bringing payload to orbit.
Yes, and attracting a lot of attention too. I mean, Elon is this great marketer. You may have remembered the launch of the Falcon Heavy rocket, mm-hmm, from a couple of months ago, and he put that Tesla Roadster into,
yes,
orbit with the mannequin. Right, he just gets so much attention, and has sort of led the way and has sort of reignited interest in space, and have paved the way in terms of these, you know, winning contracts from the government and earning their trust and showing that, yeah, we can do this even as an upstart. And Jeff Bezos and his company, they've been so much more quieter and moving more deliberately. And in fact, their sort of mascot is the tortoise. And, you know, Jeff says, you know, they want to take it step by step, but move ferociously. And he says he has another favorite saying, that slow is smooth and smooth is fast. But even in
ferociously, what's an example of his ferocity?
Well, I think what he means by that is we want to move step by step, but with some urgency. You know, we don't want, you know, we want to get up there, that, you know, time is fleeting, that if we're going to do this, we need to get get going. But I wonder, even in the Seattle area, you know, it's just now that Blue Origin is coming out more publicly and talking about what they're doing. They've been so secretive for years. You know, people don't realize Blue Origin was founded in 2000 here in Seattle, but it's only just been in the last couple of years that they've been, you know, coming out publicly. And that's in part because they've only recently, in the last couple of years, started launching rockets.
Bezos is not as much into colonizing Mars as Musk is. Why is that?
Well,
we talked about the Earth as the zoned residential, but they seem to have a different. Bezos said something about Mars like, yeah, there's no bacon.
Right.
No whiskey.
Yeah. And he says the idea is to preserve Earth. I mean, Earth is this great place with, you know, bacon and whiskey and waterfalls. And it's just a beautiful place. Mars, as he would say, by contrast, I've heard him say this a few times that, you know, by comparison, you know, Antarctica would look like a garden paradise compared to Mars, you know, where it's freezing cold, it's toxic, there's radiation, you know, there's limited atmosphere, limited gravity. You know, it's not, Earth is probably a lot more comfortable.
By the way, should we take Bezos at his word when he says, trust me, I want to preserve Earth? I mean, is that, how much reality, how much PR? He is your boss, by the way, right?
Yes.
He owns the Washington Post. Right. You're a Washington Post reporter.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you point that out. And we treat him as fairly, you know, as anyone. We treat him the same as anyone. That's what our editor, Marty Baron, has said. And, you know, it took me a while to get him to participate in the book. It wasn't just him granting it. But I do think that he is sincere about that, and I'll tell you why. Because he's been talking about this vision of space since he was a kid. You know, like I mentioned in his high school speech, and when he was valedictorian in Florida, he talked about using space to preserve the Earth. You know, and now all these years later, he's still talking about that. And I think to understand him, you know, of course, Amazon is a big deal and we all see him through the lens of Amazon. But to really understand him, I think you have to see him through the lens of space, which is one of his real passions.
How different is he from, say, a Richard Branson who you say said to Paul Allen during a test, isn't this better than the best sex you've ever had? I mean, there's humanitarian and then there's thrill seeking.
Right. And that's what, you know, Richard is all about. You know, I mean, he's got his whole, you know, portfolio under the Virgin brand. And, you know, he sees going to space and having that moment of where you have tourists going up into space and being weightless and floating around the cabin as a really cool sort of adventure, you know. And he's a guy in terms of, and I document this in the book, to, you know, create publicity for all of his different brands would pull off these stunts like ballooning across the Atlantic and ballooning across the Pacific. Mm-hmm. And this is like the next big great adventure. He also wants to do like point-to-point transportation where you go to space. So you go to like New York to Shanghai in an hour or so, you know, and he's working toward that. You know, so is SpaceX says they're doing that too, but we'll see.
It's a different mindset from these different billionaires. I can't imagine Bill Gates saying to Warren Buffett about a malaria vaccine test, isn't this better than the best sex you've ever had?
Yeah, somehow I don't see that either.
What about exploitation? Is it possible to exploit a planet that has no life on it? Is there a healthy debate around that?
Well, yeah, and there is, and particularly with Mars. I mean, I think, you know, like the moon, for example, is seen as essentially a dead planet, but there's big concerns about going to Mars, and there are planetary protection in place, where if you introduce, you know, outside bacteria or viruses to a planet, you know, NASA has some real concerns about that. So before going to Mars, you know, SpaceX, you know, obviously would be working very closely with NASA, probably in partnership with NASA, but there are a lot of regulations that they would have to meet in order to be able to do that and get them to sign off on it.
By the way, so far we've talked about white men. Is there a way that that homogeneity affects how we're using space?
Well, you know, it's interesting because these four billionaires all are white men, but they're in the book, at least two female characters that play huge roles. One of them is Gwen Shotwell, the president of SpaceX, who, you know, is in some ways the backbone of that place. I mean, Elon is the visionary and the founder and also known as the chief designer. But Gwen Shotwell, as the president, really keeps the trains running on time. Another key person in the story is Lori Garver, who is the deputy NASA administrator, who really pushed for favoring these commercial companies and reaching out to them and getting them to fly cargo and crew to the International Space Station.
Again, the book is The Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. And the author is Washington Post reporter Christian Davenport. You know, astronauts who have seen Earth from space talk about how it changed them, their sense of perspective and humility. What perspective do you find in these billionaire space entrepreneurs?
Well, I think they want that perspective to be shared much more widely. Right now, it's something like only 550 or 560 people have ever been to space and have had that moment you're talking about. It's called the overview effect, where you see Earth from a great distance and realize, you know, that we are in space. Earth is, you know, in orbit around the sun, and, you know, we call it Spaceship Earth. And that they talk about the transformative effects of that experience of seeing Earth from a great distance. You know, that Earthrise photograph that I think it was the crew of Apollo 8 took, where they're coming around the moon and then they see Earth, you know, sort of half in shadow and realizing how fragile it is and how sort of lonely it is in the blackness of space. And, you know, I think these billionaires, they think that if more people were able to go to space, and, you know, think about if it's 10, 15 years from now and they're able to do this reliably and safely, right? And let's just point out here that this is incredibly dangerous. And Virgin Galactic has already had a fatal crash. But if they're able to do it safely and that more and more people go and the cost comes down and you're at that point where you know someone or you know someone who knows someone who's been to space, and you're at a dinner party and, you know, they can talk to you about it, I think they would think that's really transformative. I mean, to the point where it would have a huge effect on society. So we'll see.
We'll see. Christian Davenport, author of The Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. And he is speaking tonight at the Museum of Flight, 7:30. You're talking with our friend from GeekWire, a space reporter, Alan Boyle.
My friend, too. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah. Christian Davenport, I enjoyed this talk. Thanks a lot.
Let's talk again
and watch what these billionaires actually do.
Be happy to come back anytime.
Good. Looking forward to it. The Record on KUOW Seattle. And speaking of the Earth, you know, there's a sun that shines on us and there's some stuff that traps the heat down here. And we'll talk about weather and the pros and cons of all of that in a moment. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Where are those sandals? What did I do with those shorts? We've got a little heat wave going on. It could reach 80 degrees tomorrow. And if this is your first spring in Seattle, you might be thinking, wow, all that stuff about, oh, summer doesn't start until July 5th. That's a myth. They just were trying to keep new people from moving in with that kind of stuff. Well, if you are new to Seattle, you're visiting, our next guest, Scott Sistak's got a message for you. Scott's a meteorologist for Como News. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Good, thanks. When's February coming back?
In about 48 hours.
Tell me about that.
Well, it looks like, as usual here, especially in the springtime, getting a really long, sunny and warm streak's pretty difficult. And about what we've got this week with about 3-4 days in a row is about the most we can ask for. So clouds will be coming back Friday, and sorry to say, the weekend is looking much cooler and a little wetter.
You say that April doesn't really have a personality weather-wise.
Right. I say it kind of borrows from the months behind it and the months ahead of it, because we're really in that transition. We've still got, you know, a little bit of lingering coolness from the winter, and then already starting, you know, the days are getting longer. You know, the sun's giving more energy to the atmosphere, and we're starting to see some of the summertime heat. And so we're kind of in that tug of war of winter not wanting to let go, and summer saying, no, let me in. So.
So this week, while it's summerish, what have you been doing, Scott, after you're done forecasting? What do you do with that, with this time we have?
Well, you mean personally?
Yeah.
Both of my daughters are very active in softball, so it's pretty much go out of the office and head outside and go see a softball game.
Okay, got it. What about the rest of spring? How much do we know about what we can expect?
So there is good news coming off. Right now, April, I'm pretty sure, it's the third wettest on record. So this week has been pretty much well-deserved. And then after we have a little rain this weekend, it looks like we're going to bounce back to some well-deserved sunshine next week. So once we get to like around Tuesday-ish next week, looks back to sunny and warmer than normal. As far as beyond that, the long-range forecasts that we look at for like the late spring and the summer are pretty favorable. And they're indicating, once again, we're going to have a pretty warm and relatively dry summer.
By the way, it must be funny to hear us talking about a heat wave from someone who's just come here from most other places in the country.
Right. I figure at least someplace, although it's been a cool spring back east as well, but I'm sure, you know, we're sitting here like, oh my goodness, 77 degrees, you know, where's the air conditioner? And most people are like, 77, this is like typical February, March for us. So
yeah,
at least we don't have the humidity to worry about.
How do our quote-unquote heat waves, how do they work here?
Well, usually you have to hold back the marine air because weather most of the time runs west to east. So for us, that means most of the time the air is coming right off the Pacific Ocean. And unlike the East Coast, the Pacific Ocean around here just offshore is like in the low to mid-50s for temperatures. So it's always kind of like its own natural air conditioning. And so I would say, you know, 9 times out of 10, we've kind of got that little air conditioner going, keeps things temperate. But when we have a rare pattern where it shifts around and the wind is blowing from the east, like we have today and tomorrow, that's what kind of holds back those cooling breezes from coming in. And then there's a little added bonus that the mountains actually, as the air goes over mountains, it when it sinks, it gets a little warmer, called compressional heating. And so it's kind of a double whammy. Not only does it hold the cool breezes back, but it kind of warms, you know, the wind that's coming in from eastern Washington.
And those are the facts from a meteorologist, Scott Sistek, for Como News. You can ask him your own questions. You can find him at a softball field today and tomorrow.
That's right.
Scott, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Now, if you're thinking about getting out to enjoy all this weather for now, we want you to keep some things in mind. Springtime also brings some safety challenges here in the Northwest. We have Fitz Cahill here, creator of the outdoor podcast Dirtbag Diaries. Welcome back, Fitz.
Thanks for having me.
People want to get outside. They want to explore, especially when it warms up. But what do you want people to keep in mind?
Yeah. I think there's a couple of things. Is that down here, we live at sea level. And these high temperatures hit, and all of a sudden, it's really easy to sort of naturally extrapolate that it's great out in the mountains.
And it must feel good everywhere.
It must feel good everywhere, and that's incredible. But there's a couple things that are worth thinking about when you plan your next adventure, especially if you're not, if you're new to the area and you're getting familiar. You know, I think most people go to the dramatic and think about bears, and bears are probably the least of your worry in this situation. Realistically, I think the first and foremost thing is that a lot of these trails, they haven't had time to get clear. So a lot of the, you might look at a map and be like, oh, I want to go there and go there. And the reality is that that trail may not be totally ready. So it's great to check in with the local radar station and see whether something like that's happening. Beyond that, you know, I think that there are some things, is I think that there's a couple things that happen at this transitional time of year in the mountains. And I think one of the most things that people underestimate is water. Maybe they go out and they get hot on a hike and they see a beautiful river, something like Icicle Creek out by Leavenworth. And
at least that one's named appropriately.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the instinct is to be like, it's, you know, into the 80s right now, I'm hot, I'm ready to jump in.
I need a cool dip.
Yeah. And I think that the first thing that, you know, you need to think about is where you're jumping in, because that's for real. Like, there is an incredible amount of water coming out of the mountains right now. And one of the things that happens is people can get in and they don't think about what's downstream of them. And, you know, it's really tempting to sort of see like some little cliff and be like, oh, I'll jump in. But before you jump in, I think it's always worth to look around and think about how you're getting out.
It's rushing and it's cold, right? This is snow melt.
Exactly. And every year it happens is that there are accidents out there where people, you know, basically underestimate that the water is cold. So you don't, you know, your body will instinctually tell you it's time to get out of that water really quickly. But if you don't have an exit plan or strategy, you know, that's a mistake that people that are new to the outdoors can make oftentimes.
And I've had the personal experience of camping with my little daughter in August. It was either July, I think it was August, on the snow. You know, it's not warm everywhere just because it's warm here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it is actually, it's really funny to think about, you know, you were pointing out that summer doesn't, you know, there's a joke, it doesn't start till July. And even into July in the mountains, especially in years where this cooler springs, there's a lot of the snow hasn't melted. So when you start to get up into the high country, you know, coming off Snoqualmie Pass or Stevens Pass, is that you will actually encounter snow quite quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, that presents its own set of challenges for people that are exploring our alpine areas. The snow, you know, on a cold May morning, April morning, even though it's sunny and it's great in Seattle, that snow can oftentimes become pretty slick and it's possible to slide. That happens pretty regularly. I think a lot of search and rescue people can attest to that. If you are go out in the mountains and you find yourself on snow that's super firm, bad things can happen, and they do.
And even weather aside, Fitz, just again, some people might be new here or relatively new. Maybe they haven't been out much in the mountains, and it's just we just had somebody, a woman died in Wallace Falls in Snohomish County, and we don't exactly know what happened. She was found in the pond below the lower falls. But just in general, if you're new or not new, you need to remember that you're going to a dangerous place. That's maybe part of why you're going, but remember that.
Yeah, I mean, I might temper it as like I don't necessarily see the mountains as dangerous per se.
Okay,
but
you tell me.
They're worth planning for, and they're worth thinking about. And I think that one of the key things is that when you start to go out on your and explore, is do it with someone else. You know, like yeah, as you get comfortable, it's fine to go out by yourself. But I think the reality is that, you know, in theory, two minds are better than one, and a lot of times that temper is getting into trouble. And right. that's a huge part. So I would encourage people, especially if they're getting to know their trails, is like it's more fun when there's more people involved usually, and it's a great way to do it. I think the other thing that happens too, to again to that point about the snow, is sometimes in this early season the snow can be on the trail. It can be easy to lose your way. I think that sometimes that does happen, and that's a real thing. Is I think that you know, in these early stages where it's not everything's melted out, that's a really easy way to get lost. Yeah. Is to like lose a trail because it's covered by snow, and then all of a sudden you're there. So it's like, that's a pretty good heads up. If you see that, maybe you think about, well, maybe it's time to, you know, save that one for a month down the road.
That's a good heads up. And don't go there alone. It's not time for solitude. The Seattle freeze, that's for Seattle when you're headed up.
Exactly.
Come along with somebody. This is Fitz Cahill, local nature writer, founder of Dirtbag Diaries, a podcast that shares stories of outdoor adventures. Friend of the show. Good to see you again, Fitz. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW, produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jima Brempong, Jason Pagano, our social media producer today, Bree Ripley. Tomorrow, 50 years ago, two Seattle brothers started one of the first official chapters of the Black Panther Party outside of California. They're going to be on the show tomorrow. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill Radke.